Okay, thank you for listening. You were just listening to the protest in Albany and against hydrofracking. And my guest for the 9 o'clock hour is Sandra Steingraber. And Sandra, thank you for joining me on the radio.
My pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. Now, you've written a couple of books about cancer and environmental risks and links, is that correct?
I have. I've written three books on the general topic of health and the environment, and the first one indeed is on cancer, living downstream, and the second one was about environmental chemicals and their ability to sabotage pregnancy and childbirth, and the new one is about the ways in which chemicals interfere with child development, so it kind of continues the story from birth up to and including puberty, so I kind of cast my net in a little bit different water. And it takes up the question of fracking. So it's just out, and I think that because we here in upstate New York are at the crosshairs of a national debate on fracking, the book has ended up kind of in the middle of all that.
And for those who are not familiar yet with fracking, what are some of the potential risks and concerns that you see as alarming for people to be aware of?
Yeah, it is easy to feel with this topic that you've walked into the middle of a movie. And I think some of that, frankly, was deliberate. So fracking is a newish technology that really came to the Northeast in around 2004. It was pioneered by Halliburton. And Halliburton was successful as it rolled this technology out to exempt it from all federal environmental statutes. So it's not regulated by the EPA, it's regulated by the states. Therefore, a lot of the chemicals it uses don't have to be disclosed. So that makes it really tough for us in the research community to try to understand the environmental health effects because we don't have access to knowing what chemicals are being used. So that's sort of the basic issue. So what fracking means is to fracture the shale bedrock under our feet, which is in upstate New York about a mile down below us. And inside that bedrock shale formation is a lot of are a lot of bubbles of so-called natural gas, which is the chemical name for which is methane. And the reason they're down there is that the Marcellus Shale, and that's the name of this particular formation, is called Marcellus, and it was actually named after Marcellus, New York, which is a little village here in the Finger Lakes area, because in that village, this shale actually kind of comes blistering up out of the ground. And so it not only is the bedrock, but there's an area where it just comes poking up out of the ground, and you could actually see it. Otherwise, for the rest of us who don't live in the village of Marcellus, the Marcellus Shale is a kind of invisible landscape that we never see, but forms the bedrock, you know, many thousands of feet below us. And the reason that it's this geology is now in the crosshairs of the energy industry, like Exxon and Halliburton, basically the biggest companies on Earth, is because it represents a graveyard. 500 million years ago, 400 million years ago, this whole area of upstate New York was an ancient ocean, and there was not enough oxygen in the atmosphere back then to decompose the bodies of living things when they died. And so when the squids and the sea lilies and the other little creatures that lived in this inland sea died, their bodies sank down to the bottom of the sediments and turned into bubbles of natural gas. So that's why they're there. And then, you know, over time they were all petrified and lots of other layers of stuff got buried with them, including a lot of heavy metals and radioactive isotopes from what used to be a mountain range that existed just to the east, kind of where the Catskills are now. So those mountains entirely eroded into the bottom of this ocean, and a lot of the things that they contained, including lead and mercury and arsenic and strontium and radium and so forth, they're all bound up with the natural gas too. So fracking is what it says it is. It fractures that whole formation, it blows it up, and then tries to get those bubbles of gas to flow up a pipe. And to do that, you have to not only exert in tremendous amounts of pressure, which is done with high volumes of water, millions of gallons of fresh water for every well. But to that water, you have to add certain chemicals to reduce the friction. There are biocides, very powerful pesticides, because they're actually living organisms down at that depth that feed on the hydrocarbons. So those, and those will slime up the pipe. And then there are corrosion and rust inhibitors and all kinds of other things. And so those also go down. And the issues to be concerned about for us who will end up living in the gas patch if this all comes to pass, is exposure to all the air pollutants created by the thousands of diesel trucks that have to service each well with those water and those chemicals, as well as the condensers and the compressor, so lots and lots of diesel exhaust, and also air pollutants released from the wellhead itself, like benzene and toluene, and then in addition, risks to water, because all of our drinking water wells lie on top of the Marcellus, so you have to puncture our drinking water aquifers over and over again, kind of like a voodoo doll, just to get all those pipes down there.
Now, some people who I've spoke to said it's not a concern that they're going through the aquifers because it's going to be encased. Is there a possibility for that casing to break and leak what the fracking fluid that's being injected in?
Well, there always is a possibility of things going wrong, and it's not a huge with any one well, the chances of the casing being improperly inserted, or that there be some kind of inherent materials engineering flaw is frankly small, maybe on the order of 1 or 2%. But then when you take a look at how many wells are planned for upstate New York, you realize the risk is much greater, because all these bubbles of natural gas are dispersed. It's not like they're all in one big place, right? We've used up all the easy-to-get gas, the kind where there's a big bubble under the ground. You just basically stick a straw in there, and up comes the gas, kind of old style. That's basically gone, and that's why this is a really fascinating moment in history now, because to get the stuff that's remaining out of the ground, all these little sort of effervescence of dispersed bubbles that are scattered sideways through the shale, requires lots and lots of wells, and as many as 77,000 wells are planned for upstate New York. So immediately you can see that it will industrialize the part of New York that is also the breadbasket. This is where we do a lot of farming. Mm-hmm. So you're going to be laying over top of vineyards and orchards and pastures, this whole series of wells and drills and pipelines and roads and pits to pour all the waste that comes up and so forth. And so so that's one piece of it, but also even if there's a 1% chance of the well casing messing up as it goes through the aquifer or cracking as all the those bad chemicals that you pump into the shale to shatter it, about half of those come back up and have to pass back through the borehole that goes it bisects the aquifer, the drinking water aquifer. So if a 1 to 2% chance, then and 77,000 wells, then some well for sure is gonna, there's gonna be an accident, and all it takes is one well to permanently contaminate a large amount of groundwater. So I'm saying, as a biologist, I think this is an inherently dangerous technology, and I'm asking, is this the path we really want to go down now? In a larger way, not just for upstate New York, but for the whole world. We are seeing an increasing need to serve our fossil fuel dependency with these very tricky to get hydrocarbons, whether we're talking about blowing up mountains in the Appalachians to get the coal out, tar sands removal in Alberta to take tar right out of soil underneath old forests, things like deep sea oil drilling 6 miles, deep off the coast of New Mexico, and the 6 mile into the Mexican, the Gulf of Mexico. So the question is this is it now not time to pause a moment and say, is this the path that we really want to go down? Because at some point, it's a law of diminishing returns. The energy gets dirtier and dirtier when you start taking into account all of the emissions released just in freeing these difficult-to-obtain fossil fuels from the ground.
And besides it getting dirtier, isn't there less return? You need to use more energy to extract the energy that you're extracting?
In some cases, that's right. With natural gas, the case is that it is a more energy-dense fuel than coal, for example. And we know that coal has lots of problems. Coal is naturally contaminated with mercury, and so when you light it on fire in an oven, in order for us to turn the lights on, you do release large amounts of mercury into the atmosphere. So there are many people who are troubled by fracking who nevertheless believe that because natural gas actually has is more energy dense and is not contaminated with all these other things that we worry about with coal, that, you know, we have no other choice but to go forward. It's the lesser of two evils. But what I'm arguing in my new book, Raising Elijah, is that, in fact, when you look at the whole life cycle analysis of natural gas, not from the starting point where you're lighting a unit of it on fire in a utility, mm-hmm. and comparing coal versus an equivalent amount of natural gas, but when you start with just getting it out of the ground, then it looks different. And this is not just me saying that. There's a new study out now from two scientists at Cornell University, Tony Ingraffia and Robert Howarth, a geological engineer and a biogeoscientist, who finally did a kind of life cycle analysis of carbon and coal, and it turns out that natural gas produces at least as much carbon dioxide as coal if you include the extraction process, which involves a lot of leakage of methane into the atmosphere, unburned methane. And unburned methane, when it leaks, is actually a more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So it doesn't last as long. Carbon dioxide lasts a century, and methane lasts maybe 20 or 30 years in the atmosphere. But it's a more potent greenhouse gas. It's 20 times more powerful at its ability to trap heat in the atmosphere. So all these debates are going on a very big national level right now. The two authors of the paper I just mentioned, along with me, were gave a congressional briefing last Friday in D.C. There's hearings going on today in Congress for which I was asked to submit evidence for the environmental health effects of fracking. And of all the chapters of my new book, Raising Elijah, which deal with a whole bunch of different threats to pediatric health, not just fracking, I think it's the chapter on fracking that seems to be capturing everybody's imagination. So I'm arguing this is the human rights movement of our time, in the same way that for us in upstate New York, you know, 150 years ago, it was slavery, right? That and many upstate New Yorkers, including Harriet Tubman of Auburn, played heroic roles in finally divorcing our economy from slave labor. And we now need to formulate a new human rights movement to divorce our economy from its ruinous dependency on fossil fuels, which I argue in Raising Elijah is as much a homicidal abomination as was slavery in times past.
That's a very interesting proposal. Just to get back to when you were talking about the coal and burning coal and it having mercury in it, isn't there also concerns about this natural gas containing radon or radioactive elements as in the gas form?
Well, strictly speaking, it's not, you know, inside the methane itself. Again, the methane bubbles don't rise all by themselves from their home, a mile below our feet. So when you have to shatter the bedrock to get the methane out, yes, there's a lot of radioactive isotopes in that shale. That's why all of us in upstate New York have to worry about radon in our basements, because, you know, it just radon can just worm its way up from the bedrock and accumulate in worrisome levels in the houses that we build on the surface of the earth. So when you shatter that layer and create more fractures and fissures, and you also bring up to the surface all this what they call flowback fluid, the chemicals that they pump in to fracture the shale, so about half of that comes back up, and there are radioactive elements in that. And so it becomes an issue when we try to figure out where we're going to dump the massive amounts of stuff, including the drill cutting. So even just going down there and drilling the hole to put the pipe down that far, it's a narrow pipe. It's only a few inches across, but when you think about how far down it goes, about a mile down and then often a mile sideways. So this is a technique that allows you to drill straight down and then turn at a 90-degree angle and head sideways. So when you bring up all those materials from that distance, you get tremendous tonnage, you know, mini truckfuls of this stuff that then has to be dumped somewhere, and that is highly toxic. Mm-hmm. And there's no regulations that prevent it from just being dumped in regular landfills. Here in the area I live in, near Ithaca, New York, we know that a couple of years ago, toxic flowback water from Pennsylvania was dumped into Cayuga Lake, and that included radioactive materials, and it was dumped through a wastewater treatment plant in a village immediately across the lake from where I live. I live on the west side of the lake. So basically a half mile from where I live, a half mile from where my children swim, the drinking water aquifer from my village is right next to the west bank of that lake. And I think that revelation, which came, you know, we all read about it in the New York Times a couple of years after the fact. That was a real shock to all of us, and we began to realize that how can we possibly regulate this? How can we, concerned citizens, make sure that this is done properly when these kind of surreptitious dumpings just happen, you know? So I have deep doubts that this can be done safely at all.
Mm-hmm. Now, even if you're not living in an area where it's being drilled, you can still be at risk for all of these contaminants in the way that you are contaminated, either coming through a solid waste authority or through the water treatment, correct?
Yes, and so I guess that's the one piece we should be clear about here, is that New York State is the only state right now in the United States, and there's 32 states where fracking is going on. We have a temporary moratorium put in place by our previous governor, Governor Patterson, who he also had grave reservations about whether or not this made sense as an economic activity for New York State. And what makes a lot of people in New York pause is realizing that even though we sit on top of an immense amount of natural gas, I mean, the Marcellus Shale here is said by the energy industry to contain more gas than almost any other shale formation. And yet, also, we are densely populated, and the Catskill Mountain area, which is the watershed for New York City and basically 8 million people, is the biggest unfiltered water system in the United States. And so if we are wrong about the safety of fracking and that watershed was contaminated, it's not just one farmer's well that's ruined. You know, it puts millions of people at risk. So for that reason, New York has been, I think, of all states, the most foresightful in saying, let's just hit the pause button for a while and study this first to see if it can be regulatable to make it safe. Mm-hmm. And if not, then we're just not going to allow it. And happily, Governor Cuomo has issued the same message. He says he's still trying to, you know, look into whether or not it's safe or not, and he has pledged that New York's water is quote-unquote sacrosanct, and that he won't move forward if this new technology is inherently not safe. And so we need everyone in New York to make sure the governor sticks to that pledge. And the most immediate task in front of us is the revision of a document that was completed years and years ago, which is an environmental impact statement about what fracking will mean for upstate New York. And but everyone agrees that it was badly done, that there were many, many things that that document didn't include. One of them were health effects of the people who live in the gas patch, who will be exposed to all the air pollutants and the water pollution and have ruined drinking water wells. So there was no attempt to study public health effects. And there was also no attempt in that environmental impact statement to look at cumulative impacts. And so it looked at, you know, the kind of contaminants that one well might produce, not considering that you won't be living near just one well. You'll be surrounded by dozens of wells. So it's the cumulative impact of all 77,000 wells and what it will do to our air and water that needs to be considered. And so this fatally flawed document now is in the process of being revised. But what we need is an ability to have a public comment period and slow the process down and not have this rammed through, because it's as early as the end of the summer, the new revisions could be complete, and we won't know if those revisions were thoughtfully done. I mean, this is a huge document. So the most important thing for listeners to know is if they have concerns about fracking in New York, the path to slowing this whole thing down is through a careful and slow, deliberative look at this new revised environmental impact statement. So we need people to be asking the governor's office to have hearings on it, to let the public weigh in with the comments on it, and so forth. And if you're, and if listeners are interested in how they can participate in keeping fracking out of New York, I think the to-go-to place would be the website toxicstargeting.com. There's a letter there that listeners can sign in on to the governor, and it has the language and the description of, you know, what this document's all about. It all sounds sort of technical, but it's the best. Right now for us in New York State, it's the best and most science-based way to take a look at the risks of fracking and let the iteration of those risks actually serve as our ability to say no and to slow the process down.
Mm-hmm. And what about the Look Before You Leap Act? Are you familiar with that in the Assembly?
Yeah, there's all kinds of exciting and new bills going forward in the Assembly. There's that one and several others that are actually calling for, you know, outright bans, and that are there's one that I'm not in agreement with, this kind of water withdrawal one, which would actually make it easier if fracking companies actually do come to New York to get their hands on water from ponds and streams and so forth. And so there are various stages in the Assembly, and any one of the state-based anti-fracking groups could provide detailed description of where each of those are in the process of committee or when they'll be up for a vote. But I know there's a lot of action on these different state bills.
Are there any counties in the state that are exempt from the ban currently, or it's the whole state is?
Yeah, it's the whole state. Because Halliburton was so successful in exempting this new form of energy extraction from all federal law, the federal government has almost no ability to regulate it under the EPA or under the Clean Air Act or Clean Drinking Water Act or the Safe Drinking Water Act and so forth. And so so it's left up to the individual states to do that. And municipalities don't really have the authority in our state to say things like, we're just not going to allow this to go on here, or we want to regulate it in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And so it really is up to the state government. Nevertheless, starting with Buffalo, New York, different municipalities have passed resolutions banning fracking or banning certain kinds of heavy industry that almost will certainly apply to fracking. So starting with Buffalo and including several villages, including my own, here in Ulysses Township in Tompkins County, as well as, I think Dryden is working on one, and there are many others passing these local bans. So in case the state of New York does the wrong thing and opens up the floodgates and allows frackers to come in, these little municipalities have forbidden it. And that will be interesting to see how that plays out, because it almost certainly invites lawsuits from companies that have, you know, are basically some of the largest economies in the world, and will, you know, versus, you know, a village lawyer. So it's like the Chinese guy standing in front of the tanks. But it's a powerful sign of resistance, and I think it's made more powerful by the fact that fracking is a kind of shock and awe operation. You can't just do a little bit of fracking. It's not profitable. In order to do it, you have to have this whole interlocked and interlinked system of infrastructure, including pipelines, including roads down which all these 18-wheelers hauling hazmat are going to be rolling and so forth. And so one or two towns that decide we're not going to allow it, you know, you can't, a fracking operation can't just kind of leapfrog and skip over that a couple counties, and then it has to all be kind of interlinked and interlocked. And so, in fact, a small village saying no could have a very powerful effect. And as a PhD biologist and a kind of considers myself kind of a scientist in the public interest, I feel like this is an incredibly interesting time just to be alive and doing this work, because I can go to these little village board meetings in the basement of a firehouse or in a library on a Friday night and see older people in the community stand up and say, I'm ready to stand in front of the trucks. You know, we have to do all we can. I saw a man in my own village, you know, my neighbor, who's a great-grandfather, say, I'm doing this for my great-grandson, Parker. I will defend his water. So how this is all going to play out, I have no idea. It when I was in Washington last week, and it was clear to me that the Obama administration is kind of moving forward with this in spite of our lack of knowledge about the long-term environmental health effects. It seems like this steamroller, you know, that's moving inexorably towards us. And on the other hand, when I'm here in upstate New York in the communities doing sort of scientific presentations on fracking, I feel like I'm watching this wall of resistance arise. So it's like watching a steamroller approaching a brick wall. And I have no idea how this is going to turn out. But it's an amazing thing to bear witness to. And I do believe it is the human rights movement of our time, in the same way that abolitionism was, you know, in the 1830s. And here in upstate New York, we also played a transformational role in women winning the right to vote, with beginning with the convention in Seneca Falls and ending with a new constitutional amendment. And so I see now upstate New Yorkers once again acting in heroic ways, and could really transform the whole nation's energy policy. And it's an amazing thing to be part of. And so I just encourage everyone who's listening to kind of be part of this, to open your eyes, decide for yourself whether you think fracking is a good or bad thing, and be involved, because it's not often that we have moments, you know, that our lives happen to correspond to these really key moments in history where huge decisions are being made that affect many generations, and we could play an outsized kind of heroic role in the way forward. But this is such a moment, and I feel called now to make this, as a biologist and as a mother, to make this my life's work. So in Raising Elijah, I titled the book as I did because my son, who's now nine, whose name is Elijah, is named for an abolitionist named Elijah Lovejoy, who was assassinated in my hometown, near my hometown in central Illinois in the 1830s, for daring to say that slavery was a homicidal abomination. And even though people had invested a lot of their wealth in slaves, it was an issue of property rights, and if you outlawed slavery, you would destroy millions of dollars of wealth instantly. Nevertheless, it had to be done because it was wrong. And for that, he was, you know, pumped full of five bullets. But nevertheless, he sparked, he inspired John Brown. He inspired Harriet Tubman. He inspired his best friend, who was the president of Illinois College, to run an underground railroad. And his best friend's sister was Harriet Beecher Stowe, and she was inspired to write Uncle Tom's Cabin, which influenced Abraham Lincoln as a young man, and so forth. And so I think we can't always see the power of our actions. This is a time where all of us should be involved in this issue. It's here at our doorstep. We didn't ask for it, but so far we've resisted it, and that resistance movement is growing stronger and stronger. So our actions here in New York have already inspired others around the world. I was speaking before the European Parliament in Belgium in December, and people asked me lots of questions about what New Yorkers were doing about fracking because it had arrived in Europe. And now we see that France has turned its back on fracking and has said no. South Africa has said no to Chevron. And Quebec is also declared a moratorium on fracking. So it's an amazing moment to see how this is all going to play out.
Wonderful. Now, at the April 11th protest in Albany, do you remember hearing a speaker who was from Buffalo who said that her water was contaminated? She wasn't from Buffalo exactly, but
yes,
somewhere near there.
Yes.
How did that occur?
Well, okay, so there's two kinds of fracking. One is called vertical and the other is called horizontal. And the horizontal fracking is what we have a ban on. So the woman who spoke at the rally and who I also then lobbied with comes from a village not far from Buffalo and lives near wellheads that practice vertical fracking, which is allowed. In fact, vertical fracking received an exemption from this temporary ban that Governor Patterson placed on horizontal fracking. So vertical fracking means you just drill straight down, and then you can pour water down the borehole and all those chemicals and shatter the shale and bring the gas up. But you're not turning the drill and then drilling sideways through the shale. So the amount of shale that's, you know, shattered is much less, and the volume of water used is much less, as is the amount of chemicals. So that is still allowed to go on in upstate New York, for better or for worse. And so this woman was had brought in samples of her water. You know, it was very dramatic because she had them in all these containers that she had collected over time, and they were clearly filled with really nasty-looking stuff that and different colors at different days. So her point was, even with vertical fracking, you know, you can still have ruined wells. And she's a mother of eight children, and so she described the kind of health effects that they were describing. So I think her testimony was powerful to suggest that things can go wrong, you know, and even with the lesser of the two kinds of fracking, you can ruin water.
And also I heard that in Cherry Valley there's fracking going on, so that must be the vertical.
It probably is. I mean, I think that the companies are sure that just, you know, sooner or later they'll be able to do horizontal fracking. They're, as long as they're not doing it now, they can put a lot of things in place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not always easy to know exactly what's going on.
Could you tell me about the natural gas that's coming from Alaska?
Yeah, so one of the points I've been making in when I'm lobbying or speaking various kind of halls of power is the kind of incoherence and lunacy of the economics around fracking. Because I was in Alaska recently in my work with the Alaska Community Action on Toxics there, learned that there, well, let me back up a minute. As most people know, there's a petroleum pipeline that goes from the north slope of Alaska down to Valdez. And so a lot of our own domestic petroleum production comes from Alaskan North Slope oil. And that pipeline was built, of course, over the objections of lots of folks, but there it is. In the process of drilling for petroleum, a lot of natural gas is also liberated. Natural gas is a kind of euphemism. It chemically refers to methane, and along with a couple of other things mixed in that are basically the vaporous fraction of petroleum. So petroleum is a mixture of things ranging from really heavy, sludgy stuff like asphalt all the way through the lighter weight molecules that we refine to make gasoline. That's the big quarry. That's what we want mostly. And then the very light stuff on the top that's a vapor at room temperature represents methane, and we call that natural gas, right? So when you take petroleum out of the ground to refine for gasoline, you get a lot of natural gas up. And it was Sarah Palin's idea, so it's not a radical left-wing idea, to build a parallel pipeline that would carry that natural gas that comes up with the petroleum to market. Environmentalists didn't really object to that because the petroleum pipeline, the damage, you know, had already been done. So if you build a second pipeline parallel to it, it sounded like a better idea than what they're currently doing, which is just flaring off the gas as a waste product. So that gas is, coming up, and it's being burned, but it's heating nobody's house. It's doing no useful work. And it's just going into the atmosphere right now. And so the plans were made to build a petroleum pipeline. But they're now put on ice. So the whole project was shelved. And according to the Alaskan newspapers the week I was there, it was precisely because we're doing so much fracking here in the east that we've created a glut of natural gas and lowered the price of gas to the point where it's not profitable to build the pipeline.
And the price is artificially low because they're externalizing the costs of our drinking water and health.
Well, of course. I mean, all those costs are always externalized for any energy source, whether it's coal or whether it's petroleum or whether it's natural gas. Mm-hmm. But I think when you don't have an energy policy, as the United States does not, and you just allow capital investment to drive your energy policy, then you end up with these incoherent results, you know, that make sense only to a few stockholders but don't make sense on any sort of national level, which is to say that we could be using North Slope natural gas and that would obviate the need to blow up the ground under our feet here in the Northeast, where we do agriculture, where people live, and where the water here is the water source for 8 million people. Except we can't do that because we're so busy blowing ourselves up here that we've lowered the price of the commodity to the point where we just flare it off in the North Slope of Alaska. You know, that's the kind of incoherences that are the result. And this is why you need policy. You don't just let profitability help you decide how you're going to turn on the lights of a whole nation.
When I had mentioned to someone about the state that the hydrofracking is exempt from the Clean Water and Clean Air Act, they seemed to feel reassured that it would still be regulated at the state level. So what would be the difference between state versus federal regulations on it as far as safety?
Well, one of the big ones is that, you know, this very states that are welcoming fracking because they see it as a jobs creator, they see it as a kind of an environmental savior, are the desperate states that have already that are already bankrupt. So in Pennsylvania, at the same time they initiated a gas rush, they also slashed the number of people to serve as enforcers. And here in New York, where we also have terrible budget problems at the state level, you know, we've cut already so many jobs from the DEC that it would be there's only a handful of people who exist to to be checking and monitoring on all these wells. And we're talking about, again, up to 77,000 wells, at least 36,000, maybe 90,000, but 77,000 is the number kind of that people use as, as a reliable estimate. So probably there would be thousands of wells under every DEC employee's supervision. So there's no possible way that they can be monitoring and enforcing things at that level. Moreover, even if everything goes absolutely swimmingly, without any accidents, without any well casings, without any blowouts, and all the things we've seen happen in Pennsylvania, even if we do it perfectly, the technology requires 1,000 tanker truck trips for every well, all right, times 77,000 wells. I mean, that is a lot of zeros. And so we're going to be filling rural roads that were intended to bring horse and buggy farmers to market, these little two-lane icy roads with tanker trucks. And they're all running on diesel, and there's no way that you can regulate that. You know, diesel exhaust puts into the air a host of chemicals that are linked to death, essentially. Fine and ultrafine particles kill, and they kill by creating heart attack. They interfere with cardiac rhythm, creating pacemaker problems of the heart. They're linked to diabetes, stroke, preterm birth, which is the leading cause of disability, asthma, and so forth. And so even if everything goes really well, we are going to be adding tremendously to the health care costs of New York by increased risks for all kinds of problems, and not just respiratory ones, talking about cardiac problems, stroke, and diabetes and preterm birth, and these are very, very expensive health problems. And the fine and ultrafine particles that are produced by diesel exhaust are not regulated at all under the Clean Air Act. So there are just a lot of ways that we're going to be impacted that the law doesn't really offer us protection.
Sandra, I'd like to take this time to open the phone lines to anyone who has a question for you. And unfortunately, the way the phone works here, I'm just going to have to put you on hold, take the call, and then relay it. I can't get you both on the air at the same time. So if you're out there listening and you'd like to call in with a question, the phone number here is 315-859-4200. That's 315-859-4200. And so I may cut you off in mid-sentence to try to answer a phone call after this. But could you tell me who the chemical suppliers are, who the big players are in that, or are you not familiar with?
I certainly don't know, and I don't know if anyone knows. I would imagine those are pretty carefully guarded trade secrets, but that would be a good question for a journalist to see if they can find out. I do know that because natural gas is used as a feedstock for a lot of chemicals. So in other words, when we think of natural gas, we tend to think of, you know, the blue flame on our stove. We tend to think of that kind of whooshing sound of a furnace kicking on in the middle of the night. And indeed, that natural gas is used for all those things. But it's also a feedstock used to make petrochemicals. And so we make PVC plastic out of natural gas. So the credit card in your wallet, garden hoses, vinyl siding, the vinyl, and, you know, that gives you that new car smell inside of your automobile, that all has its starting point natural gas. And that's a really interesting thing to meditate on, is to take a look at all the vinyl in your life and realize that that started off as bubbles of methane in some geological formation that had to be blasted out of the ground somewhere. Natural gas is also the starting point for things, chemicals that we use in farming, pesticides and fertilizer, most specifically anhydrous ammonia, which is used in the grain belt part of the Midwest to practice very large-scale industrial agriculture, wheat and corn specifically is a big user of anhydrous ammonia, and that's the main source of nitrogen pollution in drinking water wells as well as into the Gulf of Mexico. So the big dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is due to runoff of anhydrous ammonia fertilizer. 5% of the world's natural gas supplies are destroyed in order to make anhydrous. So natural gas is the I say destroyed, I mean that it is used, it becomes natural gas. It's used up in the process of making natural gas is used up in the process of making anhydrous. And of course, a lot of us who are hoping that the world's food system moves away from petrochemicals, because I think it's dangerous to run a food supply. You don't want your food supply riding a tandem bicycle with the energy sector. I think it makes it very vulnerable. And a lot of us that are hoping in this kind of momentum around organic local agriculture, the problem is not that we can't feed people with through organic means, because now organic farming itself has evolved in such a way that it enjoys yields and profits and output on par with conventional farms and doesn't have the destructive effect on the environment. The problem is that organic agriculture is more expensive. And when we put into the marketplace more supplies of natural gas, you're simply going to drive down the cost of some of the really harmful chemicals that we want to see phased out, and make it cheaper to do the industrial style farming. So there are all kinds of consequences. If we pursue natural gas and create a lot more of it, there are consequences for our food system as well. So we know already that the chemical industry is gearing up for more production of petrochemicals because of an anticipation that there will be more supply of natural gas to use as a starting point. So we have some good reports on that. More refineries are in the works, and chemical production at a number of shops is increasing.
Do you know what chemicals the fracking industry has disclosed that are known carcinogens?
Yes. Here's how it works. They're not required to disclose the cocktail that they use at any one wellhead, and in fact, in order to frack, every place is different, and so even within upstate New York, the shale is a different thickness. The depth is different, and so they have hundreds of chemicals to choose from, but they may use only a few dozen of them at any one well. And the chemicals have to be used in sequence, so they're not just, like, it's not like a cocktail where you just add the chemicals to the water and pour it down the hole. So part of the reason for using the chemicals is, one is to reduce friction, so you have these slickeners, because, you know, when you're pumping millions of gallons of water down a borehole that's only a few inches across, there's a lot of friction. But other chemicals are actually used as thickeners in order to carry the sand grains down there, and they have to, of course, turn a corner. And the point is that you're blowing up the bedrock with explosives, but then you want to hold the cracks open for the gas bubbles to flow out. And to do that, you have to force into those cracks little ceramic beads or sand grains. And to get those into the cracks requires, you don't want them to settle out, especially down at the bend where the pipe turns. And so you use these thickener agents to kind of carry the sand grains along. And then once you get them in there, you have to pour another chemical in there to thin all that thickener out, to break all that up and make it thin again. So these things have to be used sequentially, and they're sort of every well is going to be different, right? And so what we do have is a very good inventory of all the chemicals that we know are being used, and that has been collected by a shop in Colorado called the Endocrine Disruptor Exchange. And so if you want to go to the website TEDx, like FedEx but without the second E, so TEDx, you can access the database that has all the chemicals in it. About a third of those that we know are used in fracking are carcinogens, and another 40% or so are endocrine disruptors, by which we mean they're chemicals that are known at very low levels to be able to interfere with our hormones in our bodies if we're exposed. And that's the reason that's important, is because hormones are designed to have really big effects at very, very tiny levels. So, you know, you can go through puberty at parts per billion level, and that's a very dramatic effect, as we all recall, based on vanishingly small amounts of hormone. And so any chemical that has the power to act like a hormone in our bodies can have these huge effects at very tiny levels, which is why we have special concerns about chemicals that kind of meet those qualifications. So TEDx is the place to go if you're interested to know what are the possible chemicals they might be using. But right now, the way the laws are is if you have a well, 150 feet from your house,
you can't ask. Can you hold that
yes.
thought? We have a call. Sandra?
Yes.
The question is the slick water hydrofracking different from the hydrofracking that was taking place in the 1950s?
Yeah, it is. I mean, and the difference, I mean, the whole name for this new technology is slick water high volume horizontal hydrofracking. And the reason it's different is because of the horizontal piece of it. So when you make the drill go down and then turn sideways and extend sideways through a thin shale formation as much as a mile, then you have the ability, well, first of all, you need much larger volumes of both chemicals and water, and you're shattering a much bigger area, and you have, over top of that, all of our drinking water aquifers and people's houses. And so the way the law is written, these industries can come in and kind of frack underneath you without your permission, because it's thought that property rights don't extend down into the bedrock.
And so that, the name of that particular piece is called compulsory integration?
Compulsory integration, and every state does it differently, right? And so here in New York, my understanding is that if a certain percentage of your neighbors have agreed to allow fracking on their land, I think the number might be 60%. I'm not sure about that. Then you're going to get fracked whether you want to or not. And so that has allowed the representatives from the so-called landmen, representatives from the company, to get people to sign even when they have grave reservations, because if you're going to be fracked anyway, you might as well sign and then get the royalties from the profits. Whereas if you don't sign, the story is it's going to happen anyway, but you won't get anything from it.
There was a speaker here at Hamilton who was from the USGS, and he said you still have to get, they have to give you royalties.
Well, that might be. I'm just explaining what people's perceptions are.
Yeah.
So people are, this is what people believe to be the case.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, you were talking about the endocrine disruptors before the phone call.
Okay, well, just that if you live near a well and you don't necessarily have the right to ask what chemicals they're using in that particular well. So you can go to these databases like TEDx and see the whole inventory of what we know they're using across the United States, and there are hundreds of chemicals on that list. But at the well near which you live, they might be only choosing a few dozen or a handful of the chemicals from that bigger inventory.
So the big inventory they disclosed...
Well, the inventory comes from various sources, and so, in fact, when Theo Colburn is the scientist who heads up the Endocrine Disruptor Exchange, when she started that list, she actually got some of that information simply by reading the chemical code numbers on the sides of the tanker trucks, and that's there for first responders, you know, in case something goes wrong. You can also do things like take a sample of frack fluid from this so-called flowback fluid from the pits after the fracking fluid comes back up out of the ground with the gas and has to be disposed of. You can kind of do some reverse engineering and take that into the lab and see what's in there. The problem with trying to figure it out that way is that there are naturally occurring contaminants down under the earth that also come back up, including things like, you know, toluene and benzene. So the question is, well, what, were they using those chemicals in their recipe, and then they came back up with the flowback, or were those chemicals liberated from underground? And then the other question is, does that matter?
Right.
Because you're going to be, you know, whether the benzene and the toluene were ingredients, or whether or not they were, those are just lightweight hydrocarbons found under the ground that got liberated after the fact. You know, benzene causes cancer without a doubt. It's a known human carcinogen. It also causes defects in human sperm, and in that way can be linked to sabotage pregnancies. And we know that toluene is a developmental neurotoxicant, which is to say that it acts like lead in pregnancy. It makes it sabotages fetal brain development in a way that extinguishes human intelligence. So maybe it doesn't matter to you if you're a pregnant woman or a man with sperm who's living next to one of these, whether or not it's a byproduct or whether it's actually an intentional part of the recipe when you're being fracked. But it sort of matters because these chemicals are in trucks traveling on the rural roads, We need to know what we're driving next to. You know, I'm the mother of a 12-year-old, and in a few years she's going to be learning to drive. Do I really want our teenage drivers sharing icy back roads with trucks hauling really highly hazardous materials? And so that raises other kinds of safety issues.
Mm-hmm. Is there any plan from the industry of treatment of the wastewater? Is there any way for them to decontaminate it?
The technology doesn't exist to turn frack fluid back into drinkable water, if only because it's radioactive and you can't filter radioactivity. I think the lesson of Japan shows us that. I guess we haven't really talked about that. So essentially, you have this kind of sequential cocktail of chemicals that are mixed with water. Basically, the amount of chemicals used per well is about the volume of a small backyard swimming pool. So tens of thousands of gallons of chemicals are mixed with millions of gallons of water and pumped under the ground. And then more or less, you know, about half of that comes back up. So half of it is entombed under the ground, hopefully permanently, because we wouldn't want it to find its way back to the surface, because it's very, very toxic. And then when the gas comes back up, when the gas starts flowing out of the well, then there's a lot of what's called flowback. So about half, you know, 40-70% is under the ground, and then the remainder comes back out and has to be disposed of somewhere. So not only does that flowback contain all the chemicals we added to begin with, but then it is very often, especially in upstate New York and Pennsylvania, would be radioactive. And it contains brine, which is that old seawater, you know, that's been trapped down there for all those millions of years. So it's very salty. There's no way of turning that back into potable water. And even if we could, we'd still have to, even if we had a filter, right, the magical filter that could turn all that back into pristine water, what would we do with all that radioactive, all those heavy metals? Arsenic causes cancer too. I mean, it's naturally occurring, but as long as it's bound up deep within the earth under our feet, it's not going to hurt anybody. But you bring arsenic to the surface and causes lung cancer, it causes bladder cancer, and it's a developmental neurotoxicant like lead, so it makes kids stupid. So what are we going to do with it all if we could filter it out? This is a kind of the Achilles heel, I think, of fracking. It generates huge amounts of toxic waste, and we don't have a plan for what to do with it. Out west, it's injected into underground injection wells, so it's returned back into the earth, for better or for worse. But we don't have the geological strata here to do that. So in Pennsylvania, it's simply been dumped into surface water through water treatment plants that aren't really equipped to deal with it, because every well is going to bring up, depending on the specific geology at that site, is going to be bringing up different chemicals. So even the company can't really tell the sewage treatment plants, here's what we're bringing you to filter out.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know themselves necessarily. So we know in Pennsylvania, for example, that fracking, chemicals linked to fracking that we know are found in fracking, have raised the bromide levels in certain areas, and that's a problem because when you then try to chlorinate that water for drinking, you end up creating these what's called trihalomethanes, these kind of disinfection byproducts, which are also carcinogens. And so, you know, simply releasing this stuff into surface water, which has already happened in upstate New York, even though we're not fracking, the fracking flowback from Pennsylvania is brought here for disposal. Mm-hmm. So, and as are the cuttings, the drill cuttings, all the muds and stuff that are also radioactive are dumped into landfills, some of them here in New York. So we're already being affected by drilling activities in Pennsylvania.
And I heard that, I believe it's Madison County here, their landfill was approached for fracking solids, and they refused to accept them because of the radioactive.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that.
I just heard it last night from someone working with them. I believe that that's the correct one.
But and are you, where is Madison? Are you in Madison?
No, I'm in Oneida County. So,
okay.
But Madison County is very, it borders Oneida County.
I see.
Very close. Let's see, is there anything else that we haven't covered that you would like to speak to before we wrap it up?
Well, I just want listeners to feel like this is an issue that there's a place for them to be involved. You know, this is, I think, the issue of our time. And my dad, at age 18, went off to fight Hitler. You know, the day after he graduated high school, he was on the boat. And so the issue of his time was to defeat global fascism. And as somebody who grew up in a German-American family, Steingraber is German for by the stony ditch, you know, I have this awareness, as do a lot of German-Americans, of the different loyalties and opinions of our fathers and grandfathers. So there were members of my family who lived in Germany at the time and chose not to see the signs of atrocity all around them. And then there were people like my dad who were sent off it as a teenager to combat Panzer tanks. And so we have a name for those people who chose not to see the terrible things going on around them and call them good Germans, and they're not considered heroes. I don't want to be a good German in the middle of an ecological holocaust. I want to be a member of the French Resistance. And so this is a time, even though fracking sounds all complicated and technical, either we're going to pursue very toxic forms of energy extraction and lay waste to upstate New York, or we're not. Or we're going to find another way forward based on renewables. And if you have opinions about that, this is your time. This is the moment to be a hero and to get involved. And no matter what skill set or talents you bring with you, like I'm a PhD biologist, so I know I'm a pretty good organic chemist, so I can talk about that. I'm actually very shy, so I'm glad I'm talking to you on the phone, because I would never want to be the one to go like door to door, try to do organizing or things like that. Mm-hmm. But probably some of your listeners have those skills. So everyone has something, you know, and we're all now kind of musicians in this great human orchestra. It really is time to play the, you know, get off fossil fuels, save the world symphony. And you just have to know what instrument you hold and find your place in the score.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you.